This is from the Midwest City Free Baptist Church.
So the book of Acts, in chapter 6, we come upon something. I'll show it to you, and I'm really sorry I couldn't resist. I just crammed all this on a screen. If it hurts your eyes, don't you ever forget now that we have these old-fashioned things called print Bibles that are accessible to you. So you could take one of those up if you choose, okay? Acts chapter 6, this is the beginning of the chapter. We're going 7 verses deep. And so it says this: "Now, in the days when the disciples were increasing in number, a complaint by the Hellenists arose against the Hebrews, because their widows were being neglected in the daily distribution. And the 12 summoned the full number of the disciples and said, 'It is not right that we should give up preaching the word of God to serve tables. Therefore, brothers, pick out from among you 7 men of good repute, full of the Spirit and of wisdom, whom we will appoint to this duty. But we will devote ourselves to prayer and to the ministry of the word.' And what they said pleased the whole gathering, and they chose Stephen, a man full of faith and of the Holy Spirit, and Philip, and Prochorus, and Nicanor." You're going, wait, Stephen I know, Philip I know, but Nicanor? Once again, possible Bible name for your next baby, just in case, or someone you're Nicanor. "And Timon," or Timon, or Timon, or you say it how you like, "Parmenas, Nicholas, a proselyte of Antioch." These are the ones they picked. "They set them before the apostles, and they prayed, and they laid their hands on them, and the word of God continued to increase. And the number of the disciples multiplied greatly in Jerusalem, and a great many of the priests," how about that? "A great many of the priests became obedient to the faith." And so this is the word of God, and it is efficient, it is effective, it is powerful enough for the teaching. And so, may it teach us. I got a question for you. Did the early church have clergy? Did the early church have clergy? It's an interesting question. We've been looking at the early church, the earliest church, here in the book of Acts. And this question then, it sort of speaks to, obviously, the idea of leadership, the issue of what the church looks like, how its leadership looks. Of course, the New Testament ends up having quite a bit to say about different roles and different people with callings, gifts, and so on. We'll talk a little bit about it. It ends up having a lot to say, but thus far, just as far as we've come, 6 chapters into this story of the early church, we haven't seen a lot of that. And of course, we look around today, and all of us know today what the landscape looks like. You look across all the many denominations and the non-denominations, you know, and you can't help but notice quite a bit of variety. And one of those things where there is a lot of variety is a lot of differences in how leadership is organized and structured, isn't there? It sort of looks different. Sometimes we say, well, what's the right way? I mean, we see this across the board. And really, I mean, so far, here we are reading about the earliest church. We haven't seen any of that just yet. I mean, all we have in the early chapters is you got apostles and you got a bunch of converts. You got a lot of people that there have been a lot of dramatic conversions, people being added, new believers. You got all these new believers and you have the apostles. I mean, probably there were those who had been followers before, right? Come, but it's sort of all it's talking about is here are the leaders, the apostles, it's the apostolic church. And then all these people. That's kind of what we have so far. But here now, in this passage we just read, really for the first time in the whole narrative of the early church, you see the beginnings of something that's going to end up being really important. So here we are, human beings, you know, running all over this planet, organized in all kinds of ways. Just think big picture for a second. Man lives in a world of hierarchies. Sort of by necessity, right? We live in structures where some people are always above other people. Some people always occupy certain positions that are at higher levels. I mean, you can't walk out of your house, you can't do much in life without recognizing that there are sort of ladders or structures of leadership. Some people are over other people. It's a natural tendency of us a lot of times to overemphasize these ideas, to sort of see people as somehow better than other people, and somehow intrinsically or by nature given to leadership. Like some people are way up here and they're superior to people who are way down there, as if it's somehow essential. Now maybe today we don't think that way so much, because after all, we're Americans. We don't think that way. We think less like that than other people have. You think of all of the old world dynasties or monarchs and all that. You know how that worked in places today. It's still true, by the way. But we just don't see it. We don't live in those places. The idea that, you know, you have sort of a king, and the king was born to greatness, you know? Born to be better than you. Born to be better than everyone else. Superiority, as it were, in the genes, you know? Like they talk about, he comes from royal blood, right? Comes from kingly stock. It's like, you, who were you born to? Nobody? Well, see, that person is better than you. That's the idea. And some cultures, rulers were even seen as divine. Right? We know this too. They were seen almost as gods. And that is still the case sometimes today. Now, not everybody thought that way, because there were always times and circumstances where it would be evident to people, it would be revealed to people that, you know what? The king, he's no god. I mean, this is sometimes obvious even in times and places. I mean, come on, all you'd have to do is be close enough. Surely they knew they weren't. I mean, they might have fooled themselves into thinking they're great because of how they were born, but I mean, deep down they had to know what they really were. You know, recently was the Ides of March. So it's funny that even in Shakespeare's telling of that whole account where, you know, Julius Caesar, you know, all the people start to worship him. And what does he say? What do his inner circle, the people that know him well, they said, wait a minute, this guy's no great figure. He's no god. I mean, he's a great general. But in the one scene, one of them says, yeah, you know, when we were younger, we went swimming in the river out in the Tiber. He couldn't swim very well. I had to save him. He was flopping around like a little girl saying, oh, help me. And now this guy is some god? You see, people would know better a lot of times that really wasn't the case. Nevertheless, it's ironic because the Roman emperors after Caesar would end up being worshipped by cults that would think that they were gods. That's just a tendency of people to look at hierarchical structures, to look at the great ladder of, you know, leadership, and to say, oh, some people are just better than other people. Like you just came into the world better. It's just how it is. It's almost like it's in your DNA. Greatness is in your DNA. Of course, all it takes is one really lousy king to remind people that that's not true, is it? You know, one of Shakespeare's quotes is one of them says, great wombs have borne bad sons. Yeah. Yeah, you know, that's usually in most cultures, the best candidate to be the king is probably somebody else. But you're stuck with whoever just happened to be born to this person. Well, in a religious context, it's sometimes the same idea. We sometimes have a similar idea. Many religious people around the world in many different religions, you see this, where somebody is seen as super special, great. Somebody is given all the authority. Somebody is specially anointed, called, unlike anyone else is called, has a higher authority, speaks for God maybe, whatever it is, the shaman, you know, in some cultures, the guru, the witch doctor, maybe the monk, depending on where you go, this idea, you find it everywhere, don't you? Somebody has, there's a religious expert. And that person, in some cases, is the everything, does everything. You take your sick to this person. You bring all your offerings to this person, all the sacrifices to this person. This person conducts all the religious ceremonies. This person is your link to the supernatural. This person is your channel to the divine. And this is common in religion. Well, what about the church? How is it then with the church? So in Acts 6 here, we still see we have a young, very young church, a brand new movement, this brand new kind of family of people. And the leaders are essentially the apostles. They are, and they are anointed in a sense, right? They do have a sort of special calling. They had spent the time with the Lord Himself. They were given a verbal commission in person by Him. And He is attesting to their authority with these special signs to show that, yeah, they are my guys. So special signs are being done through them. But if we then look a little closer at the chapter and we see what they say in response to this little problem they have, there's a lot we learn about the church and how the church is supposed to be and how leadership is supposed to be by what they say in response. It's really kind of funny, isn't it, that, you know, it doesn't take long when the church grows and a lot of people are added. It's funny how that whole passage starts by saying, there arose a complaint. Well, I mean, it is the church after all. I mean, you know, if there's one thing true of the church, there shall arise complaints. Because we're just people, right? The church is people. So wherever you find a church, you will find complaints. Right? And just like to wherever you find any group of people, you're going to find complaints. So yes, there arose a complaint. And you know, some complaints are legitimate. I mean, not all complaints are bad. Some of them aren't legitimate, and some of them are. But here we have, there's a problem that arises. Now, we got to say something about this. We got to make some sense of the passage. So just to make sense of this description here, how you have the complaint by one group about another group. Who are these people? Well, in the earliest stage of the church so far, it hasn't gone out very far. It's just still in one spot. It's still here in Jerusalem. You have a lot of new believers, but who are they? Where'd they come from? Well, they're made up of people pretty much from a Jewish background, which makes sense. That's where we are so far. It's in Jerusalem. The audience is pretty much a Jewish audience. So they come from a Jewish background, but there were distinctions among all the people who were first century Jews. They were not all exactly alike. And here in this passage we see one of the little distinctions. They're all Jewish background, but there are a couple of different kinds. You have some of these from a Jewish background who were tied to the land, tied to this special, their sacred holy land, their homeland. And so they had only lived here in Palestine, and they pretty much spoke the Aramaic, which is, you know, like the Hebrew dialect of the time. But there are others who were there who don't live there, who weren't raised there, because there is this thing that had happened where Jews have been scattered. They call it the diaspora. So you got Jews living in all these different towns and cities and places of the empire, but they come together. They come together during the holy days, the feast days, and to celebrate in Jerusalem. So you've got some of these new Christians are those kind of Jews. They came from that background. They don't speak Aramaic in the house. Now they know the Hebrew and the religious worship, you know, in order to read from the scrolls. But their everyday speech is Greek, like the common world speaks. And they probably have picked up little cultural things from where they live. Right? They probably have picked up little things of wherever they come from. So, you know, it's sometimes this way with religious groups. I mean, you know, if you have, for example, if you ever talk to different Muslims, for example, you know, there are Muslims from places like Indonesia, and it's a little different from them. They might make their Hajj trip to Mecca, but when they get there, they might mix up with locals who live in Mecca, and they're true Arabs who speak Arabic. And they're from there. And these other guys, they're Indonesian. So there might, sometimes there's a little bit of a superiority complex. I mean, we're the real thing, you know. We don't have to try to learn the Arabic. You might get this. You know, when I lived in Salt Lake City, there was always this sort of running thing about how I would meet visitors. I was downtown a lot. And downtown you got this Temple Square. It's like, that's the Mecca for Mormon people. Around the world, the Mecca. So they would come. I would meet people from all over. When I would just be chatting with people, I would encounter people from all over who were there because they made the journey to come see the great original temple. See? But the whole thing that everybody knew is you knew the difference between those Mormons from other places and the local Utah Mormons. They're not the same. See what I mean? This is the kind of the idea. There are cultural differences. So I show you here, I think I even wrote you a nice description, lest you wonder, Hebrews and Hellenists, these are just two words used to designate. Hebrews, just to use the term to describe the local Jews who are Jewish in terms of tied to the land, speaking the language, have never lived anywhere else. They're Palestinian by birth, And that's where they've always been. Versus Hellenists. Hellenists is just a word that means Greek influenced. So like you could define it as having Greek influence. Taking on Greek culture. That's what Hellenism is. The spread of Greek ideas, Greek culture, Greek ways. So that's what these Jews had been like. But they've all believed the gospel. They've all now joined. They're all part of this new church. And we know something from the passage about what we know some of what the church was doing. We've already been informed of it by other passages. So we already sort of knew it. But we're reminded of it here. It's made clear again the fact that there was distribution going on. Like in other words, there were some of those who needed help. And in the ancient world, widows especially needed assistance. Just the way that the social structures were such that it was difficult for the widow. By the way, it's still difficult today for single mothers, isn't it? Even in our time. A lot of single mothers, it's tough. Now in the ancient world, it was even that much more difficult for women sort of going it alone. And so they looked for help. So one of the many things the early church is doing is it's helping them. So what is the nature of this complaint with all of that being said as by way of background? What is this complaint? It's essentially the idea that, look, some of us who are culturally kind of like from this group, we notice that when it comes time for the help to be sort of distributed, there's sort of favoritism going to those kind of with this cultural background. By the way, can people in a church tend to huddle together in accordance with people who are most like them? Could they show favoritism like that? Of course. Favoritism is an easy thing to do. We're just drawn to people like us. Doesn't the Apostle James have to remind the Christians and say, hey, look, don't show favoritism to some people over others, because maybe you like how they dress. They look more like you, act more like you, sound more like you. They're into your kind of things. Your hobbies are shared. The church can, and so far as it is natural, can be multicultural in many respects. We don't go out of our way to try to force the issue like we're trying to meet quotas, right? Like, but it certainly should be. It should be as wide open as the local community needs it to be. I mean, and I've seen churches where you see this. I mean, some churches will have those in them. You might think they're all the same. I say, oh, you might look at a church and say, well, this is a middle-class suburban white church. This over here is a rural church. This is an inner-city black church. This is a Hispanic church. And from the outside, you know, they all kind of look the same, seem the same. Maybe they talk. But even in those congregations, you will have cultural differences. Because they may all seem the same to you, but some of them might be very high income and some low income. And some may be sort of like from some kind of educated class, and some may be blue collar, and some may like, you know, some may find their free time hunting and fishing, and some of them find their free time, you know, I don't know, bowling, or some of them, they're into different things. They like different things. They go to different places. Culturally, it might be different. Their style isn't always the same. And you might say, well, they probably wouldn't go to the same church. Well, who says? Maybe they wouldn't, maybe they would, but to the degree that they come together, the church sees them all as brother, sister, doesn't matter. That's not enforced, but that can be hard to do. So they're saying, look, they're kind of naturally favoring the people most like them culturally. And they're kind of getting, so this is, it's not, there's not necessarily fairness here. And here, like I said, something very significant takes place here. When we see how this was answered. So let's look at the text again. And let's see what they do in response. So, here's what they do. Starting verse 2. And the 12 summoned the full number of the disciples. And they said, it is not right that we should give up preaching the word of God to serve tables. Therefore, brothers, pick out from among you 7 men of good repute, full of the Spirit and of wisdom, whom we will appoint to this duty. We will devote ourselves to prayer and to the ministry of the word. And what they said pleased the whole gathering, and then they choose them. So what do we get from that? Okay, that's what they did. This is a simple response. There's nothing very profound here, is there? I mean, they summoned a large group meeting. They said, we won't do this in a small room together. We'll talk to everybody. We'll bring everybody in on this. We're going to propose something. And what they propose is simple. It's simple, but yet it's still important. As simple as it is, it's very important. It can easily be forgotten. What did they not do? What was not their answer? Well, one thing that was not their answer was they didn't say, you know, this is no big deal. And we got a lot of other bigger fish to fry here, so yeah, don't bother us with this stuff. They didn't just blow it off, did they? And their answer was also not this. It was not, well, we see we have an issue. And of course, we are the apostles. So we will handle all of this. We will now take over the money, how it is distributed, how it is allocated. We'll just go ahead and take over all this and handle it ourselves. Because we're the apostles. We're the ones. They didn't do that either, did they? Was there an issue here? Yeah. Did it need some oversight? Did it need to be addressed? I think it did. Yeah, apparently it did. So was there a need for some administration here? Was there a need for some leadership in this area? There was a need. Did it have to be the apostles? No. It didn't have to be the apostles. You see what we're getting out of this? And it's interesting to see something here that it would be easily missed. And of course, I would never let it be missed because I never miss the chance to identify an important Greek word. What is it? There's a word used three times in this passage we read. Three times. That word is diakonia. Sound familiar? Diakonia. Look at how it's used in the three different places it's used. It's first used in the very first verse. Some were being neglected in the daily distribution. That's the word diakonia. The daily ministry or service to these widows. Then in verse 2, that when they respond, they say, it is not right that we should give up preaching the word to serve tables. And there it is again. For this specific diakonia, this specific service of allocating money or food or to feeding, that's a diakonia too. Same word. And then look at verse 4, what they continue to go on. They say, we will devote ourselves to prayer and to the diakonia, the ministry of the word, the service of the word. What a flexible term this is, right? And of course, later there'll be passages where the term is used, or it's the word deacon, where we see it almost as a kind of a specific role people play to serve in the church. But it's a very flexible word. And it can be kind of a very general term for service or ministry. It's that same word used both of this kind of service, where we're helping these in need and distributing basic essentials for life to help them eat, to help them get by. And what the apostles are doing is they go out, preach and teach the word. Both of them are a kind of service. And the same word is used for both. The apostles here are not saying that the service is beneath them. I think in the English it's easy to kind of get that vibe from it. We're too good for this lowly work. Are they saying they're too good? They're recognizing, A, that they can't do everything. And B, that other people can do a lot of these important things. And you know, that sounds simple, but a lot of churches don't learn this very well. I've been around a lot of churches for a lot of years because I knew a lot of people and I went to seminary and I met loads of people who were on their way to ministry in different places. And I kept up with some of them. And then when I was out kind of in a more pioneering place, I got to know all kinds of people doing all kinds of church work across denominational lines. So I've seen all this stuff. So I've seen churches that are big and very small. I've seen the churches that meet in cool-looking old-style cathedrals and ones that meet in what look like kind of a warehouse. And I've seen them in the storefront. And I've seen churches that meet in people's living rooms. And I've seen them in the rural places where everybody shows up in their overalls and they've been up since 5 and they already had to feed the animals and they already went down and had coffee and everything else. And then they came. And every kind of church you see, this lesson has to be learned of how we empower the people. The simple lesson that the apostles learned. We can't do everything, and we're not called to do everything. What would happen if the apostles said, we'll do it all? And the bigger the church got, they said, no, we'll do it all. You guys just chill out. Just sit still. Just, your job is just stay. Sit right here. Oh, and also remember to pony up some money. Well, there are a lot of churches where the idea is the people come. The people sit. The professionals put on a show. It's like we live in an entertainment culture where we're used to that, right? The people come, the people pay, the people enjoy the show, right? And they sit in a seat and enjoy the show. But the church was not meant to be that, right? The church is not meant to look like that, where leave this to the pros to do it all. Because I'm afraid if we let you do it, you'll do it wrong. Now someone will mess it up. Or there's just the idea that we need all the power. I need my hands on everything. I need to touch every dollar that comes through here. I need to know, I need to hear every word taught, and I'll make sure that it was taught right. And if I don't like it, I'll start writing your lessons for you, and you'll just say what I tell you to say. See, the apostles could have been control freaks. They could have said, look, we need a few of you to do grunt work, to be lackeys, but we'll basically control it all. But that's not really empowering people. That's not freeing people to use their gift. People are grown-ups. They stand before God as adults with gifts, and they can do things. Some of them are very wise, and boy, this is hard for some pastors to get this word, but some people, believe it or not, can do some things better than you.
Better than me? But I'm a reverend!
Yeah, and you just don't have all the gifts, bro. You weren't given, there's some guys that say, here are the spiritual gifts, and I have them all.
And some of you have one or two here and there, but I have them all.
Nobody has them all. So the apostles even recognize here that they can't do everything. If they tried, you know what they would do? They'd run around killing themselves doing everything poorly. They'd be doing everything bad. Because if you try to do everything, you don't do it well, do you? And so, it is a lesson to learn. There is nowhere in the New Testament, by the way, where it lays out a clear, definitive leadership structure for all churches. Some of you are going, yes, it does. Talk to me afterwards. Show me. There are a couple of places where it lists some leadership things. And you got the apostles, prophets, and the teachers, and some different. There are places where it gives you gifts. But there's no place where it says, here it is. Here is the official structure. And every church needs to look just like this. That's why they differ so much. We just know there are roles people play. Some people have sort of oversight, overseers, episcopal, bishops. Some people shepherd. And some of these overcross. Sometimes they're used interchangeably, by the way. But this principle here that we see, simple as it is, it's obvious. The church is a ministry of equals. It's a ministry of equals. Different people have different gifts, so they fulfill different roles. And by necessity, there will have to be some basic elements where the buck stops somewhere. Some people have to take on more responsibility. But that doesn't make anybody superior to anybody at all. It's not a power structure, for sure. Jesus told his disciples, he said, the kings of the Gentiles lord it over them. And those who have authority over them are called benefactors. But not so with you. With you, the greatest should become like a servant. That's how I want it to be for you. Not to be like it is for them. Where the big shots walk around and everyone has to grovel because they're better than the other people. 1 Peter 5, Peter says, he's instructing elders and he says, be shepherds of God's flock among you. Watch over them, not out of compulsion, but because it is God's will. Not out of greed, but out of eagerness. Not lording it over those entrusted to you, but being examples to the flock. Don't run around waving your scepter, bossing everybody around. First of all, nobody respects it, and people won't respond to it, and it's just not God's will. God's not looking down going, good job, tell them how it is. Get them. Yeah, whip them up. Put them in line. He's not up there saying that. He's saying, I called you to be a servant. To the degree that you have leadership, that's your burden. It's not your privilege. And so the parts work together. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 12, the church is like a body, like a physical body. He says, look, is the foot any less a part than the hand? The foot shouldn't go, I'm just a lousy foot. The hand is cool. The hand can text people stuff and play video games and give a thumbs up and give high fives. And the hand can shake. But what do I do? Nor should the eye say to the hand, yeah, I don't need you. You see, there are two opposite extremes here. When Paul's talking about this, he says, don't think of yourself too low and don't think of yourself too high. Don't be the foot going, I'm useless, I'm nothing, I'm nobody, I'm the church, I need me, I don't do anything important or special. Don't be like that. Nor be like the eye saying, I'm better. What I do, you can't do. Yeah, you do your thing, but my thing's better than your thing. Nobody wants that. So, nobody should say, well, you know, I can't sing, and I don't really like to talk in front of people, and I'm not the most social person in the world. So the things I do are behind the scenes, and so they're not important. Nonsense, they're not important. Nonsense. That's no more true than the person who comes on the stage and sings with a melodious voice should say, I sing well, and you don't. And so I'm so much better than thou. My gift is better. Neither one of those. Paul says, don't be like either one of those. Throughout the New Testament, this lesson is over and over for us, for the church. It's a simple thing we're doing today, right? It says nothing very profound here. Problems, the church has needs. The church has things that should be addressed. How will those happen? Will we say, I'll take that. I shall micromanage every detail. Because my ego needs to be in charge of all of it. No. We will, when they find people to a point, it's not find people with these skills and talents. The lists of qualifications are never, read through the pastoral letters, they're never talent-based. He never says, find somebody who's really got cool talents that impress you, and hopefully they're decent people too. That'd be a bonus too. No. The focus is on the character. Character first. Leadership from character. Make sure they're solid, grounded, full of the Spirit, both feet planted deeply in the Word so that they understand and they're mature believers and they're wise and they have good character. And then I'll bet you, then we'll find out what they do well. Well, there'll be some place where they're good at something. But the character is what matters. And so, what is our role? This is my philosophy of ministry. I'm trying to take it right from the Word. And I haven't always had this right in years past. It takes some hard learning sometimes. Learned some tough lessons over the years on doing it wrong. I've done it wrong, and I've watched a lot of people do it wrong. So, because we're stubborn, right? We gotta make a bunch of mistakes, and then we come back to these simple words, and we go, well, you know, the apostles are pretty smart. I thought I was smarter than them, but it turned out I'm not smarter than them. They had a pretty good idea here. And of all the people in the world, those with apostolic authority could have easily said, we'll handle it all, we're the professionals. They never lorded it over the people. In fact, they call them all together. We want to let you all know what's going on. And we don't even tell you who to appoint. You know who's good. You know who has the qualifications. You choose. And we will give our blessing. We will make it official, but you pick. And by the way, the people they picked, were they a bunch of scrubs and nobodies? Well, you're going to read about a couple of them in the future chapters of Acts. Pretty impressive people. Which tells you that they made a pretty good choice. They made a pretty good choice. They didn't pick losers here who were going to screw things up and do things wrong and do immoral things and lead the church astray. They picked people that are pretty... They knew what they were doing when they chose these guys. And we see that borne out in future chapters by the kind of quality of people they are. And that's what we want to do. You sit here this morning, you think, well, I don't know. I don't know what I do. Listen, you're a believer. You have gifts. You have abilities. You are being discipled throughout the course of your life. You're a person of character. The church needs you. You're a body part. All right? You're a body part. Whatever you are. Can't, I don't want to live without my lungs. I don't want my pancreas dropping off. I can't afford to go without these parts. All the parts are important. The church needs you. You are an equal diaconia. You're a servant. You're a minister. We all are.